The topic for today is scripts and the family of origin. We wanted the tape recorder to get going, so I guess kind of formal start there. But what I'd like to begin with is concepts developed by Eric Byrne as a kind of a starter. He identified three ego states, that the center of consciousness we could categorize or have areas in the ego that are an adult logical side, and that is, you might say, we all communicate, we've all learned how to communicate, and we're good at communication. And that, we could say, is coming from our adult ego state, where we share, we give facts and information, we introduce ourselves. That's pretty straightforward. Sometimes it can be on a rather serious side. The adult is kind of the more logical, factually oriented aspect of the ego. Then there's another side, or I'm sure you've run into people or a person at a time when they're kind of bossy, or they have a great need to be in control. Or someone has all the answers, and they're a know-it-all. Well, that probably is a good quality or character of the apparent ego state. I have a son-in-law who's kind of a walking encyclopedia, and he has a terrific memory, and I gather he's probably a very smart fellow. And when you're out on a hike or you're here or there or a map, he has the history, the data, and he's very quick with the answer. Well, you soon begin to get a little annoyed with this after a while, because he's always telling you the answer and on and so on. So this is his, what we'd call the parent ego state that he gets hooked into at times. He's not always that way, and he's aware that he does it too. But interestingly, this comes from his child ego state, and that's another state that I want to bring out. The child ego state has, we could say, a light side and a dark side. The dark side is the side that may feel competitive, jealous or envious. It can feel scared or anxious, fearful, you know, the emotions. And on the positive side, it can be full of curiosity, wonder at the world and nature and animals, flowers and things. So, and in terms of my son-in-law that I was sort of speaking of there, he had an older brother who, maybe it was 7, 8, 9 years older. And some of the competitive thing got going in his relationship to this older brother. I guess in one sense he idealized this older brother. His brother was so capable in so many things. And sort of looking up to that older brother, he always tried to emulate. But he never really came off that good because he was, 8, 9 years younger. He could never really compete. So it created a tremendous need to work and strive to be right and be on top. And also, there, I think maybe a part of us too, that he wasn't quite as, his older brother was quite athletic, very athletic, and he wasn't so athletic. He's a little more on the clumsy side. So he began to emphasize shift to the intellectual side. He also had some poor eyesight, so his achievement and his competitiveness then went into being, having the answer, knowing the facts, and being authoritative. And so this was programmed from his child ego state, which was Philly's insecurity, competitive feelings, and so on. But notice how it is communicated out to others through the parent. I mean, it is perceived by others as a parental kind of thing. And this is to say that our scripts come from, to the extent that we have a script that we follow from time to time, comes from the child ego state.
You might want to define what script.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
A script would be just like, well, children often hear or told fairy tales and stories, and they're very interested in them, and they respond to them. And fairy tales are helpful to children because they do dramatize a struggle or a conflict or something that's threatening, a witch, Hansel and Gretel, and the negative witch, and the parents are up against the lack of food and their own depression. Anyway, the children are sent off into the forest, and they get lost, and so you know, there's this drama. But the thing about a fairy tale is that it always ends in a resolution and a victory for the child. And so it has an emotionally positive way of communicating to the child that these things that are all kind of going on in their life will resolve, and there is a victory, and there's a good feeling when Cinderella is discovered by the prince, and they live happily ever after, and well, there's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and so on. So these are kind of these are scripts in a sense, and they don't just have to be in terms of fairy tale, but that's where often we hear them first, is in stories, and we often have a favorite. It's Shakespeare who said, all the world's a stage, and you know, we come on as players and actors, and we have our roles, and so on. And in a way then, the script is a kind of a theatrical, should we say, script that we tend to follow, and we get programmed on. And that affects our communication. The bottom line of this is that this is the scripted, when we get hooked into the script part of our behavior, then that affects our communication, and we, what we call is then dysfunctional communication. Now, I'll just elaborate on this a little more with diagramming. Put on what Verne developed in terms of the ego states, the parent and youth. I'm going to overlap them here. And we have the parent, the adult, and the child. And this whole section then would be represent our conscious ego. And when we had our last week, we're talking about the unconscious and the dream world and all of that. That really would be another whole entity that this sort of sits as the servant or the executive of the whole self, and the unconscious factors are playing part into it. Just relating the unconscious, I think is more influential through the child ego state. Now the child egos, when we were talking about scripts, and remember there was both the dark and the light side, and there is what we call the natural child, which would be curiosity and all the realm of feelings, of feeling pain and hurt and delight and joy and fun. Those are just great out responses of the natural child in us. Then there's a developing adult. It's called the little professor. The little professor is the intuitive part of the child who kind of sees how the family system works and learns how to kind of operate and stay safe in the family system. So it's the developing adult of the small child. Then the major thing I want to focus on here is this adaptive child. This is where the scripts is started. And the adaptive child kind of learns, takes on messages from the family and positions in the family. I have a parent figure here, and within the parent, there is a parent and an adult and a child. And for the most part, most of the time, we're carrying on pretty adult in our behaviors and communicating in a straight, open way. But for the parent, there may be things that have not been, and for all of us, we don't resolve all of the things that we bring from our childhood. So there's an adaptive child level in the parent. And at this level, this person may be very scared of anger. So anger is a no-no. So anger is a problem area. And so it says there's a script around anger for this person, but this internally, this functions to program the parental ego state. And this okay, you know, the parental ego state is a good one. We all learn how to be parents by having been parented. So we know as a parent, we protect a child, we nurture the child, feed, clothe, take care of, carry a lot of responsibility. That's all parent ego state. And so there's a lot of nurturing that goes on with the child. But at this level, what has not been worked through and resolved becomes a parental message up here. Do not express anger. Do not allow any anger. I will not allow any anger. Myself, you know, the parent may always be pleasant, sweet, or kind, but also maybe when the child gets aggressive in anger, you know, we'll say to the child, no, you shouldn't. If you're not supposed to talk that way, that's bad, I'll wash your mouth out, and so on. So anyway, the parent then is communicating, and that is then also developing the adaptive, scripted dimensions for the child. Well, let's see. Well, you know, there can be messages around money, love, sex. Well, how about you naming it some too? Are you getting more that, you know, strong, that they get these strong messages about? How about school, education? You know, that'd be education in terms of achievement.
How about fear?
And fear? Yes. It makes me think of what things to be feared. Mm-hmm. What kind of message might there be about what's to be feared? What about pregnancy for a girl? Another one might be, how about violence?
A very, very timely one is abuse. The child that's been abused cannot protect its child from abuse unless they've worked it through themselves.
Okay, that's different. What about abuse?
And so the child that comes, and the person that's been abused and comes and says, my mother didn't protect me, or my father didn't protect me, is because they were too much in their child ego state, even though they may have known what was going on. They were so much hooked into what happened to them because they had not experienced it out and healed it, that they couldn't protect their children. So that would be
this
child ego state.
Yeah.
It transfers into the parent. And then the parent then becomes a child to the child, can't take care of the other child. I think that's such a timing on these days.
I was talking about earlier, anger and being fearful of anger could result in the person being more passive. Would fit in with not being able to be protective or aggressive
To confront what needs to be confronted because you're so, the parent is so hooked into the child.
Some questions or some things that are not clear in this to you, or maybe it's...
How about a child that's getting messages also from his peers, family, everything else is going on. Mm-hmm. His family does not live in isolation.
Right, okay, good.
Perfect.
Yeah. There could be other children in the neighborhood, that older children a lot of times that would say would be more threatening to a younger child, or sometimes maybe a peer who's a pretty disturbed or troublesome kid. And so, the interaction could be represented not only by parents, but by a school teacher. That might be pretty scary. And maybe gives a lot of critical messages off, that the school teacher maybe doesn't come very much, does not communicate much from her adult, but she has a great need to control and is very, has a lot of negative messages, that therefore, instead of connecting with the child at this level in her teaching, she's connecting with in her communication between her parent and the child, and evoking a child ego state rather than helping to develop an adult ego state in the child. So when we as adults honor the child as a little adult, it helps to develop that child. And vice versa, when we become authoritarian or rigid and controlling, we hook in the child into his child ego state, and particularly more his adaptive side. And, so this school teacher hypothetical one is, could be a fear, like a scary person, and hooking the frightened child, the scared child, and giving it more negative input that keeps reinforcing that. Well, at the school level, that could have a lot of effect on, I'm not very bright. I never can seem to please the teacher.
And that would be the script then that you'd live by.
Yeah.
You could live by that script the rest of your life.
To form a script, yeah. So, that was a good comment about the reality and isolation is not just the family. Another dimension, too, would be the siblings. Brothers and sisters play a part. And it's natural for brothers and sisters to be in competition. Sometimes they're close enough that one feels very much displaced by the other, and that creates a natural competition, or some natural some anger results from the one that's displaced. We've had some grandchildren lately, and do you remember a little few stories about Matthew or Sarah when Matthew is the first in this particular family?
Oh, he says.
And then his little sister.
I'm not going to hit and kick Sarah, Mommy. She says, interesting that you should say that.
Yeah, things like that. And he was able to acknowledge that he was, well, yeah, when she got pregnant, he was not pleased that she was pregnant. You know, he was. I wish you weren't. You know.
I didn't think that was such a good idea.
So we see that natural response of feeling displaced and no longer being the center for the parents, and they have to share it now.
How many of you have sensed some difference in relationships to your siblings? Like the one that came right after you, or the one that was before you, versus one that's a little more distant. Could you say a little bit about that, right here?
Oh, my older sister was perfect. And I didn't, it wasn't so serious, you know, so I remember going through learning stages and finally getting rid of that. She was a delightful person, but very able, and I guess I didn't want to find my own way, so I had to conquer that.
Mm-hmm. Must have been hard for your child
Our own daughters are the same. Our own daughters, one, the younger is quicker. She had you mentioned a very cruel kindergarten teacher.
And children began to think, if the other one does it, they should be able to do it, and I'm as guilty as anyone for not having told my younger child, but you're not supposed to have to be able to do that.
That's where I stand. Why didn't I have the strength that could have helped her more? We weren't capable.
And as parents, we sometimes are busy. We don't notice all these things until later.
Exactly.
My wife tells me that her older, 5-year-older sister was a genius in grade school, and she got so tired of going to school, seeing a teacher, you're Jean's Salmon's sister,
yeah,
aren't you?
Right.
She just loved to go to a different school where her sister wasn't known.
Yeah. It's like you become a nobody. They don't see you.
Yeah, that's right.
And then what kind of a script then does develop within the child with that kind of reaction from the world? Why aren't you like all the kids in your family? Oh, you're another one of those.
Yeah.
Like that.
You know, Burns called that kind of a negative stroke. This is when the child started school or came to, moved on to the next class, and the teacher, "Oh, you're so-and-so's daughter." Mm-hmm. Or not daughter, but sister. You know. Yeah, and so it wasn't acknowledged in the uniqueness of it. And maybe teachers say, "Oh, she was a great student. You know, I'm sure you will be a great student too." But there's a negative stroke getting put in there. Now, for the most part, you know, we can all handle a certain amount of negative stroke as far as that goes. But where it gets more started is that if, well, let's say in that same situation, the family, if the parents are very much caught up in the importance of education and achievement, and make a whole lot out of the one child, and then maybe even compare, because that will happen. You know, why can't you do like your sister, or even another? You know, why can't you, you know, behave now, and so on. And so a lot of comparison can go on. Well, those are all kinds of negative strokes that are creating the script and affecting the self-esteem.
And deters us away from realizing our own gifts. And is that why it takes so many people so long to find out who they are and what they're here for? Because you have to sort out all the stuff that people told you you were here for.
Yeah.
Any response to that?
A little competition here.
So much of our lives are spent finding out what we aren't good at before we know what we are good at. And are really cheated of using our gifts creatively because of all the things that we have had to sort out. And some more than others. Some are more free to develop.
How many of you have pencils along with your pen? Well, I guess maybe there's enough that, and we have a couple here.
Okay.
There's some scratch paper. Take a sheet, pass it around. This is gonna be a quick, simple exercise. And here's a pen and a pencil if somebody doesn't have. Anybody needing a pen or a pencil? Okay, you have some, Ellie? And there's a couple more. Let's see, here. Who needs another one?
A couple more.
Anyone else?
Here. You need one? No, she has one. Any more?
This is a simple thing to do. Squares will represent the males, and circles the feminine or female. And I suppose the square men are a little more rigid, you know, and a little more. They have women are soft and
rounded
and gentle. A man can be a little
macho
or something. Or anyway, the men are the squares and the women are the circles. And draw a larger square for your father and a larger square for your mother, and then smaller symbols for your brothers and sisters. And place them on the sheet in terms of where you feel they were related to the family. In other words, you're going to create a kind of a little pattern how the children cluster around a parent who's felt, you know, and how you see them too. Of course, how you see. Are you closer to the mother or the father? And to certain siblings. So it's nothing very final or firm, but go ahead and do that. And if you had a grandparent living in the home, or that was real, a lot of interaction, you might want to put that person in the picture. Well, as you've done that, anything kind of come clear, or, you know, how did it turn out for you? Or would somebody share a little bit about, well, that maybe how many siblings you had and where, well, how you see them? And could you see how it might have played a part in your script? How many drew themselves closer to the mother? Okay. And some closer to the father? Okay. How many drew a sibling closer to the father than mother? Okay, so there's a few that had a particular sibling as kind of, you know, being closer to the father. Someone want to share a little more in detail?
Okay, I'm the oldest, and I have two brothers. I feel I'm sort of in the middle between the mother and father. And my next to the young, I mean my younger brother, I felt he was closer to my father, and my youngest brother was closest to my mother.
Do you have some feelings or ideas about being in the middle, somewhat between mother and father?
Do I?
Yeah. Was that kind of a good place to be?
It was
a good place to be. So, like, you feel connected to both of them. Huh? Mm-hmm. But the boys get sort of, one gets identified more with father and the other closer to mother.
Well, my mother was like, I think like 36 when she had my youngest brother. Now, does that have any bearing? The
mother's
age?
Yeah, he's the last one.
Yeah, so did that...
Sure, yeah.
Oh, the last little boy. Oh, yeah. My 35-year-old son is my boy.
Yeah, you know,
for me,
if you don't want an empty nest, too, you keep hanging on to the last one.
He had to move across the coast.
And that plays a part, and that plays a part, I'm sure, in at sort of the script quality of the issues that he deals with. Over against, and then maybe some competition, although maybe there's enough. How many years between the two brothers?
4 years between each of us.
To say four, what?
Four.
Four.
Eight between me and my youngest brother.
Uh-huh. But four between, so they're somewhat close together, but enough at least to be quite competitive, I would think. Mm-hmm. Someone else?
I come from a broken home. My father deserted his family when I was about 7 years old, 8 years old. And I got my list here, my brother and myself, who my brother is 7 years younger than me, much closer to my mother. But my sister, a little bit closer to my father because she made some effort to get acquainted with him after he had disappeared and come back.
Now, is the sister older or younger?
She was 2 years younger than me, and she got along pretty well with his second wife. He finally started another family. And neither my brother and I was too much thrilled with that. But I can see that she was a friend of my dad's second family much longer than we visited them, and that was the end of it.
That was, yeah. Not too much connection there.
No.
For you. So you're the oldest boy in your family.
Oldest boy, yes.
Yeah.
So what did that mean for you and your scripts? You don't have to tell, but you know.
What did that mean for what?
You and your script. As the oldest boy without the dad at seven.
Oldest boy without the dad.
That affected how you...
Means you grow up pretty fast, I think.
Uh-huh.
And maybe held that role in the family.
Not that it was put on my shoulders, but I think.
But in one sense.
Yeah, right. I think you tend to grow up a little
yeah,
faster.
Yeah, a little fast. And to fill a vacuum there in the family.
Yeah.
Also, Well, I imagine that drew you closer to your mother. I mean, having some support for your mother?
Define support, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, let's see. Well, you know, you could be a husband substitute, I don't know, a surrogate. Anything like that happen?
I went to work pretty soon.
Uh-huh.
I tell you, I was working almost from the time this happened.
Yeah.
Reading papers, working wherever I could.
Sure.
Because financially it was a rough deal.
Rough period too.
Huh? We're talking 60 years ago, man.
Yeah, right, around the Depression.
Yes.
Yeah. So you had to grow up, you had to become an adult soon, and you had to kind of take hold and help with the family finances. Yeah. So you see how much kind of scripting, and that's not all negative, that is, see, some of it could be a lot from the adult. I mean, you saw what the situation called for and you pitched in and helped. Mm-hmm. But also emotionally, there's some hurts there, and your father's leaving, and seeing your mother left with a family to take care of, and I would gather you, at least for my role in my family, I tend to be a rescuer, a helper. Mm-hmm. And that was one reason why I found the ministry and psychology an expressive field for me, because it provided a realistic way to be assistance to people. I tended to sympathize with my mother and her situation and some of the things that were unfulfilled in her own life. So in a way I got caught vicariously fulfilling some of those for her, particularly in the field, you know, in education. She, both through both of her children, although my sister, who was 5.5 years older, she had a lot of the same hopes for her, but she got pregnant in just out of high school, had started the university, but then got married, had to get married, and it was a depression time, and you know, so she never did go back to college.
Oh.
So that was a disappointment. So you see how that scripted was a powerful script for me.
But what I wanted to say here in relation to you is it didn't leave much room for that little professor to develop, the child that has time for wonder, or the fun child.
The fun child, the natural child.
Pretty serious business.
So
I've just been thinking here something else too. About 4 or 5 years after my father left, my mother was taken seriously ill, and I can remember her going to the hospital and the adults be talking in the periphery of my hearing about whether she's been glib or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, believe you me, this is nightmare time for
somebody
who's about 11 years old.
Yeah.
And I can remember thinking over what would happen to us three children.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I ever worked it out is I had an older cousin who was awfully very nice to me. And finally one night I said, well, if she passes on, I think Ray will take care of me. I don't know about my sister and brother, but I think that I will be taken care of. But I didn't have any formats. Fortunately, she recovered, and we maintained a unit until after I left home.
Yeah.
But that can be kind of scary.
For sure.
That can be very scary.
Yeah. Was there something you wanted to say? Share something?
I was one of 7 children. The brother before me is 18 months older, but really was a scapegoat in our family for some reason. I don't know what the reason was for that. But he was, I came next, and because he was a scapegoat, I believe I was kind of the hero child and felt I was possibly part of making him a scapegoat too. I don't know, but I felt very much very important in our family.
Mm-hmm.
And special. And I don't know what, really, I'd like to understand what that was. But I felt like I was a special child. And, you know, now I see the dysfunctional part of that. Mm-hmm. I see it now. He was a bedwetter. He was a slow learner. And I remember in school, we went to a country school, my parents telling me to help him with his homework. I was a year and a half younger. But sit down and help him with his homework. Very damaging. I see that. But that's the way the family functioned. And my brother and I are very close now. He's very special to me. He treats me very specially, and sometimes has gotten angry, but immediately makes up and says, and my parents are both gone, and calls me kind of a parent now. Uh-huh. He says that I am the parent of the family, even though I'm in the middle, I am the parent. They come to my house for gatherings, and I'm kind of like the patriarch of the family. But I don't know why that made me feel special, possibly because they looked at me special.
Well, yeah, they, yeah, and it, and apparently in your relation to him, he didn't feel the judgment coming from you. You were perhaps more of a helper sibling. You know, you sort of helped him at times with his schoolwork and things like that. And yet there was, you're saying underneath it, in a sense, there was a negative message about it too. How about you? Did you feel at times much... feeling a little guilty for being made special, or in relationship to that younger brother?
I don't know. I think I just
Well, great if you didn't. I'm just wondering if at any level bothered you.
I learned easily in school. We went to the same school. We had the same teacher. All in the same room. I just felt like, oh, this is pretty neat, I can do this work. And I'd listen to the 7th grade and 8th grade, and even though I was only in the 5th grade, kind of learned his homework and helped him. You know, and I think that was why we have this bond. I could help him because I
You were in the same class with him.
Yeah, we had one room, and all of us went to the same room, so I could hear what he was learning, could help him with it. And But he was really, it was really hard for him because everyone my older brother kind of picked on him too, and they had physical fights. I can remember my dad even physically
fighting with him.
That was real hurt. That was real hard for me. I remember that. It was real painful. Now when I see anyone fight, that's a picture that comes back to me, is my father fighting with my brother. And it's really, that's really hard. Hard to live with that, to think of that.
Yeah. So that's, that could be one of the scary things, fighting and
very much so.
So how is anger, then is anger kind of programmed a no-no for you?
Well, when I see anyone starting that they argue, I just don't want them to argue.
So you don't get angry, express anger?
Very easily, not very well, no. I'm real afraid of people say, well, I get angry. That's true. But I don't
want to
get angry with him. I'm not into physical.
Well, what you're saying is that, at least I'm hearing it, that comes from the child experiences that it's conflict and argument is scary, of other people out there. Mm-hmm. And that's, therefore, is a difficult area for you now more as an adult. And this is one reason why I was drawing these little circles, the diagram, is that there's a contamination between your adult ego, we'll say, and, well, in this case it's not, but anyway, this is to indicate the overlapping or contamination between parent and adult, and over here with the circle overlaps, is the contamination between the adaptive child and the adult. So let's say in your own adult family, you have several children and you have a couple of them that are getting into a fight. Well, you know what to do as an adult to try to settle things down and get it resolved. But immediately a lot of the emotions of this adaptive side comes up. And you probably, well, I'm just guessing, you know, you get maybe more uptight, you might say more tense about it. Maybe because of this, you want it to stop immediately. You don't want them, you might tend to cut it off, see? And the more, though, you can get in charge of this adaptive child side, and maybe listen to your, work through some of that, then you, in effect, let's see, here's my eraser. You eliminate this contamination, see? And it is not then affecting your adult. And then you could say to these two or three people arguing, what is the problem you're dealing with? You know, what's the problem? What's the issue here? Maybe they've got five or six things going at once, you know, if I still deal with an argument. There's a lot of it. And so the adult can help sort out the issues. Okay, now let's solve one issue at a time. Who's got, you know, okay, let's, and or, this doesn't seem to be a good time to do it. It's right when we're doing dishes here. How about after supper? We'll see. So again, it's what help, the adult would help organize to bring the issue into focus, find a good time, find a safe place to do it. And let's say it's in the family, there's several siblings. Maybe really the argument is just between two of the people, but there may be three of them in there, or four kibitzing in it, see? So you say, well, okay, Jim, this doesn't apply to you, and John doesn't apply to you. Let's let these two have some time to resolve it, see? So well, the adult takes charge and sorts it out.
So now what you're talking about is the difference between dysfunctional and functional communication.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have the, our time. We're about 5, 10 minutes. We go to.
I think you go to 11:35.
Okay.
We have 10 minutes.
Say, okay. Now, what I wanted to introduce here, if it relates to the scripts, and is the it's called Kharkov's triangle. And it pertains to the adaptive child, particularly, or the child ego state. And there are three positions that we can rotate through. One, P is for the persecutor. And so enter P. And B is for victim. And R is for rescuer.
And probably, if you think about it, you all could place yourselves in within your family as one of those. Are you the peacemaker? Are you the one that keeps the pot boiling?
What's the R?
Rescuer.
You would be likely to be a rescuer, particularly for your brother and. And, okay, and I would think, it was it Bert?
Yeah.
Bert, you may well, at least to the extent that you're coming partly from your child ego state, in script, that you'd be a rescuer. You're the big helper, comes in and fills the empty spot of your father. Now, yeah, and then your young brother, his script got caught up in being
victim,
the scapegoat.
Older brother. Yes.
Oh, was it the older brother? Mm-hmm. The older brother. Okay. And then at times other siblings could be the persecutor, you know, blamer, critical, teaser, so on, and. These positions are not fixed, and of course they're not always operating because a lot of times we are functioning from a good adult position or a good parental position. But when we get hooked into our wounds or pains, a kind of habitual position from early childhood, that is, we get hooked into the adaptive child, then we tend to function from one of these positions. Now, for myself, just to illustrate, I already shared that I tended to be a rescuer, but I also can be, I feel like a victim too. Usually there's a couple of positions that you get hooked into, you know, because you're not always feeling good. You're always not always feeling on top of it or as a helper. But there are times where you feel you, well, you just don't, you fail. Didn't do very well. You mean, well, well, let's see.
From time to time, you recognize that you have needs too.
Yeah.
And that's when you get into your victim, if you don't take care of them.
Well, it really has to do with our trying to be perfect at times, mm-hmm. you know, and you can never be perfect. So when you fail or aren't perfect and you don't win praise and you want some praise, you want some positive strokes, and you don't get them, then you get kind of hooked back into